is Lundy versus Lundy. If more correctly, Estate of Lundy versus Lundy.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Philip Burey. I represent Kelly Lundy. I now turn the court's attention to TEDRA, ERISA, and the designation of a beneficiary under federal law.
But your opponent says you waived all that stuff below, so jump that hurdle for
us. Yeah, right. The waiver argument really goes back to 1107.010, sub 5, sub A, sub I, where the legislature, after the Egelhoff decision, said that we are going to exclude federal benefits from the definition of a non-probate asset. The purpose of that was because of the Egelhoff case saying that state law was preempted. Now, counsel at trial argued that the state statute that the estate relies on, 1107.010, could not apply post-distribution because of this exception. It was never waived. It was fully briefed and fully argued. Despite this, the trial court applied this statute with no qualifications, and that, in our opinion, is clear legal error that requires reversal. Now, in this case, there really are three issues. The first is the issue of the trial court error and the statute. Second issue is that there is no evidence that Mr. Lundy, during his life, wanted to change his beneficiary but somehow failed. It's purely a matter of presumption that the estate claims it really should go to the estate and not to the person Mr. Lundy designated as his beneficiary.
Why would we care about subjective intent? ERISA starts with a written beneficiary designation, and you want to get past that.
Sure. And it really comes down to as I understand the estate's argument, there's an argument of waiver and contract, right? That these parties somehow agreed to this. There is no evidence of that whatsoever.
Why would it matter if they agreed to it if Mr. Lundy didn't execute a new beneficiary designation?
It doesn't matter. I mean, again, if this court concludes that that designation of beneficiary is controlling regardless, then that's it.
I mean, isn't the whole purpose of the written beneficiary designation in ERISA to avoid controversy for the distribution of the ERISA plan benefits?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I'm going to anticipate.
Well, let's go to waiver then.
Okay.
The Kennedy case and waiver. Let's say we buy what you argue about ERISA. The money should have been paid to her, but they say the dissolution, she waived it. Kennedy foreshadows,
yeah,
that's okay. Why shouldn't she win?
Okay. Kennedy said only we express no opinion. That's hardly an endorsement, right? So Kennedy didn't say that states have this ability. Kennedy, in that footnote, said we're not going to decide that issue. Note that Hillman comes very close to saying state law, even after distribution, can't thwart a federal designation of beneficiary. But this is the important point. The important point is you can't have an implied at law contract provision based on a statute that excludes the very asset you're arguing about. You can't have waiver of the right to receive this benefit if the focus of waiver is a state statute that does not apply to the asset we're talking about.
Was the amendment to 1107 before or after the date of entry of this decree?
It was long before, 2002. Yeah.
Why can't a decree expressly incorporate a waiver without reference to the statute?
Well, and here we get to the harder cases, a case that obviously we don't have those facts here. But let's imagine that the parties papered this correctly in the divorce and said that the spouse.
Now, let's do one better. Let's assume that Kennedy foreshadows where the Supreme Court's going. What would it what would be necessary to constitute a waiver? Why isn't there a waiver here on the face of the decree?
Okay. What would be necessary are two things. Number one, there would have to be some express waiver where, you know, the spouse says, I completely disclaim any right to recover anything under the designation of beneficiary. And then there would be something saying, I agree that if for some reason my ex-spouse doesn't change the beneficiary, that I will disclaim any distribution and give it back to the estate. Obviously, that's not here. But even under those circumstances,
what if the decree simply recited, I hereby disclaim any interest in any asset which my husband has designated me the beneficiary of before the date of entry of this decree?
And here we come back to...
Would that be enough?
It wouldn't be enough, I allege, under current federal case law. And here...
Do you need a requirement that required the disenfranchised spouse to agree that they would execute whatever form is required by the federal government to alter the beneficiary designation?
Well, and here, look at the elaborate superstructure we are constructing around a very simple point. If Mr. Lundy wanted to change his beneficiary, he could have, right? That's all that has to happen to achieve what the estate wants to achieve here. Mr. Lundy, during the 4 years after his divorce, could have gone online and changed his beneficiary with the stroke of a keyboard. He didn't. And the fact that every time he got his benefits package, right, the little graph that shows the pie chart about, you know, I get to retire at age 75 if I'm lucky, with that, it said who the beneficiary was. That's all that had to happen here under federal law or under state law to make this designation change. It didn't. And so our argument is that the estate may not bring this state statute through the back door and argue that it was incorporated somehow into the divorce decree or incorporated as a matter of waiver when the statute itself specifically exempts the asset that we're talking about. I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Well, you'll have your 3 minutes. You won't get your 7 seconds.
May it please the Court. My name is Perry McConnell. I'm the attorney for the estate of Craig Lundy. This is an appeal of a trial court ruling in favor of the estate, and in addition to the briefing materials, as you've already mentioned, I've submitted 2 motions to the court. The primary basis of this appeal was the issue of federal preemption.
Just on your motions, we view motions to strike with extreme disfavor, and I would discourage you from engaging in that practice in the future.
Thank you, Your Honor. The reason that I had the motion to dismiss the issue of federal preemption is because at the trial court level, the appellant had an inconsistent, contradictory position. They clearly stated 3 times to the court that they agreed that the state law claim was not preempted by federal law, and then they turned around at the appellate court level with the exact opposite position, made it the primary basis of the appeal.
Well, the language was you can bring the action, but you can't win. You can file a lot of actions that you can't win because the law is against you. Why is that a waiver argument?
Well, the position stated there was that we had the right to bring the state law claim, meaning the federal preemption didn't apply, so we had the right.
Well, that's how you're interpreting it, but that's not expressly what they said. And how do you square that with the fact that they argued the statute expressly and said it precluded the relief you sought? I mean, they clearly argued that the statute didn't allow you the relief you sought.
That's true, Your Honor. They argued that based upon the language of the statute itself.
And isn't it enough that they argue at once that it's not waived?
I believe that was a separate argument about what the statute actually says,
so you're asking
not a federal preemption.
Parse the difference between statutory interpretation and statutory preemption.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what they had said at the trial court, I'm reading the verbatim trial report record here, is that this is page 28 of the clerk's papers. They said, the courts have said, I agree with the plaintiff. The courts have consistently said federal law doesn't preclude the bringing of a state court action, which is the federal preemption issue out before the court today. Should the court choose to review this issue of federal preemption, of course, our position is that the state law claim survives. And when I initially took this case, I met with the client. I heard her story. I became very quickly convinced that it was a gross inequity for this to pass the ex-spouse. I then read the Egelhoff v. Egelhoff decision, and I'll admit it was discouraging. I wasn't sure if I had a case. But then I read the subsequent case law, and you've mentioned some of that in the Kennedy decision, and found that the state courts found that a state law claim was permissive in the setting of a post-distribution action.
But if you read Egelhoff as it worked through the Court of Appeals and the state Supreme Court, it should have extinguished all hope under 1107. You're raising exactly the arguments that were raised there that our Supreme Court said yes to and the federal court said no to, except for the waiver issue under Kennedy.
Your Honor, I would respectfully distinguish the Egelhoff decision in that it was in the pre-distribution setting. So the ruling of the court had to do with whether or not you could apply RCW 11.07.010 to Boeing, the plant administrator, not in a subsequent post-distribution.
A good point, except the Supreme Court's point was that the statute was preempted. State law was preempted from controlling federal law, and federal law determines who the beneficiary is, the owner of the asset after death. And that's what state law would purport to do under 1107, isn't it?
Your Honor, our state law claim only utilizes RCW 11.07.010 for purposes of understanding what the contract was between these parties, what the meeting of the minds was in the divorce decree. We're not asking for a direct application of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And additionally, you did point out that the Kennedy decision does.
So is it your position that the decree is ambiguous?
The decree awards the asset, it expressly awards the asset to Craig Lundy.
But it's silent.
It does not state.
It's silent on the important question here.
Your Honor is correct. It doesn't expressly state whether or not
sure
this future.
I've seen decrees that have not been silent on that question, have addressed it expressly because of people's familiarity with Egelhoff.
Your Honor, in the state of Washington, there often wouldn't be a waiver, an express waiver, because of RCW 11.07.010, because that already operates to undo any beneficiary designation. So although some attorneys may be savvy enough to put that in the document.
Is there language in 1107 that exempts certain federal assets from being non-probate assets that would cause a person to have pause?
Your Honor, I would draw a distinction between the language in there, which would cause you to have pause. It says if there is controlling federal law, then it doesn't apply. So that would cause you to have pause. However, it doesn't state what the controlling.
1107 exempts at least some category of federal benefits from its operation?
Well, even in the context of our own argument, I'm not arguing RCW 11.07.010 doesn't block the passing of this asset to the plan administrator. That's why we've sued the beneficiary. So it already is
So the statute excludes the asset, but the statute's incorporated in the decree and imputes an intent with respect to the excluded asset. Is that your argument?
Your Honor, my argument is that the statute, by its terms and under the Egelhoff decision, is to be narrowly read in the pre-distribution setting. Once we've distributed this asset to the beneficiary.
If the statute excludes the asset pre-distribution, how does it describe intent post-distribution?
It informs the intent. It informs our understanding of the intent of the parties as to
how
the future.
How does it do that if the asset's not subject to the statute?
Your Honor, in the context of the post-distribution setting, if we are allowed to use a theories of state law and a state law claim, then it doesn't.
Now, you've been talking a contract theory, that somehow we're discerning the intent of the parties from this statute. How do we do that?
This comes back to my argument about where Egelhoff applies as far as preemption. That's in the pre-distribution setting. In the post-distribution setting, once it's passed to the named beneficiary, that which was Kelly Lundy in this case, then we can utilize it for purposes of interpreting the divorce decree and understanding what the parties intended regarding future beneficiary interests.
I'm getting all confused here. Is your argument that the statute is incorporated into the decree, that the statute is imputed to the parties to determine their intent, or that this is a legal theory that's available limiting the scope of Egelhoff to only pre-distribution cases? Or a fourth one, if I haven't been creative enough to come up with what to say.
Your Honor, I believe that you phrased it appropriately in the first matter, where you said that it's that this is read as if incorporated into the divorce decree, because that's appropriate in the post-distribution setting.
Well, the Ninth Circuit looked at Carmona and Emard and said, end runs around the statute or end runs around ERISA don't work. There we had, for instance, a constructive trust that they tried to apply by state law to the funds in the hands of the beneficiary. That's post-distribution.
Your Honor, the
Carmona said Emard is an end run around ERISA and it no longer survives, and that was a state California statute that said you could impose a constructive trust, I believe, on the
Your
statute.
Honor.
So again, it said the law can't create this interest, and that's why I focused when asking opposing counsel on what's the basis of the waiver, because it looks to me like ERISA is foreclosed, even in the hand, or the ERISA benefits are not available in the hands of the beneficiary unless under a theory of express waiver.
Your Honor, I distinguish cases like the Hillman decision and the Carmona decision. The Hillman decision was dealing with a separate body of case law under Feglia and was not dealing with ERISA. And all of the ERISA precedent that I've listed in my briefing materials shows that in a post-distribution suit, you can apply state law. And it's my position it doesn't make sense to allow us to bring a state law claim argument and yet not use state law to interpret a contract. For these reasons, we ask the court to uphold the trial court decision.
Thank you, counsel.
Let me speak briefly about the remedy that Ms. Lundy is asking for. We ask that the court reverse and not reverse and remand. The court's questions, I think, are exactly right on the legal theories in this case. The trial court erred by applying a state statute that is preempted for all purposes, whether pre-distribution or post-distribution. And under those circumstances, the appropriate remedy is to reverse this case and enter judgment in favor of Ms. Lundy. Unless the court has other questions, I think the court's questions show that it clearly understands the issues in this case. I yield the rest of my time to the court. Thank you.
Our next case.